The obsession with consumer payments in the Bitcoin community is an unfortunate relic of the fiat money era. Generations that have only known monetary hot potatoes that need to be spent before they devalue have come to view life as a quest of mass consumption. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we've got a wonderful read today, and we've got some really, really great interviews lining up here. I'm kind of filling my docket. They're just a little bit down the road, so stay tuned. We're going to have a bunch of really awesome interviews of stuff that I've been wanting to dig into for a while. And do not forget to subscribe. If you haven't subscribed, click the button, click the follow on Spotify, the subscribe on, or is it follow on Fountain as well? Check out the Fountain app on whatever podcast app you use. And also leave us a review. That actually does a really, really good, I don't ask for that enough. And I should mention it because it actually does make a big difference. It helps bump it in the lists and in the recommendations for people who are looking for Bitcoin content. And I want to, especially people looking for crypto crap, don't let them get lost. Leave a review, share it out. Anything you can do is a huge help and very, very highly appreciated. With that, Anil said so. At Anil said so. Which I believe we've read a piece by Anil on the show. I can't remember the title of it off the top of my head. I'll have it in the show notes if I find it. But he had a post very recently and has made a webpage of a whole bunch of critical or fundamental reads on Bitcoin, what it means, the essential essays, I think it's called. And this list is phenomenal. I'm going to read through the list really quick, because it's just a really great collection. It's Everyone's a Scammer by Michael Goldstein. Obviously, we have audio of this. Economics of Bitcoin as a Settlement Network by Saifedean, which I did not have audio for, and that is what we are reading today. Bitcoin is Worse is Better by Gwern. Bitcoin Miners Beware, Invalid Blocks Need Not Apply. Why the Yuppie Elite Dismiss Bitcoin by Croesus. Bitcoin Obsoletes All Other Money by Parker Lewis. The Stone Ridge Shareholder Letter by Ross Stevens. Bitcoin is Time by Gigi. Can Governments Stop Bitcoin by Alex Gladstein. The Bitcoin Reformation by Turtemeester. Shelling Out the Origins of Money by Nick Szabo. The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by Vijay Boyapati. Bitcoin Becomes the Flag of Technology by Balaji Srinivasan. Masters and Slaves of Money by Robert Breedlove. Decentralization, Why Dumb Networks Are Better by Andreas M. Antonopoulos. It's the Settlement Assurances Stupid by Nick Carter. Bitcoin is Venice by Alan Farrington. Bitcoin Reveals Exchange Rate Manipulation and Detects Capital Controls by Gina C. Peters. The Greatest Game by Jeff Booth. And Bitcoin and Me by Hal Finney. Now, this is an amazing list, and I have read all of these, but I noticed going through it that I think three of these are not in audio. I need to check on one other one. And so I'm going to pause my schedule outside of like interviews and things that I've already got in the lineup. I'm going to pause my reading schedule and we're going to get through this. I want all of these in audio because these are genuinely a really, really amazing reads and they all deserve an audible version. And we are starting today with Saifedean's back from 2017, which I think is a really great thing to kind of look at again in hindsight. You know, now that we're 6 years ahead of when this was written, to look at how Bitcoin is behaving as a settlement network and what it's coming to look like and how it will apply to Saifedean's analogy or Saifedean's mental model for making sense of the hierarchy of value in transactions, in layers of transactions on Bitcoin, the base layer, and then up the layers of the network. So I don't want to lead anymore. Really quick, let's thank our sponsors and we will jump in. This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. This is a super secure, super long-running, Bitcoin-only, cypherpunk hardware device. If you want to own Bitcoin, if you want to know that you own Bitcoin and you have it on a safe device, get a Cold Card. And you get 9% off with Bitcoin Audible, all one word, all caps. And if you need some extra sats to stack, you always need extra sats to stack. But if you need some extra sats for the lowest possible barrier, switch your freaking debit card to a Fold card and get sats back on everything that you do. And then send it to your Cold Card and you can get sats back. You can get 50,000 sats straight out the gate just by going to my link and signing up for the free version. Seriously, I will never go back to a normal banking debit card. I just won't. I don't know why I would ever not have Fold. And now they're going to have roundups so that like I can just put little pieces of change every single purchase. This is ridiculous. This is the lowest hanging fruit of like mega stacking on all the things that I do. I'm a huge fan of both of these companies, both of their products and services, and also love that they are supporting the show. So give them a shout out. Thank them. And check out their stuff if you're not using it. I got links, I got special things and discounts right in the show notes. It's so easy to find. All right, with that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, Economics of Bitcoin as a Settlement Network by Saifedean Ammous, May 19th, 2017. As Bitcoin's popularity continues to increase, its transaction fees rise as well, leading to the customary chorus of doom and gloom by those still stuck in stage one of dealing with Bitcoin grief. With average transaction fees exceeding $2, the doom mongers assure us Bitcoin is doomed because nobody wants to pay $2 to make a payment when credit cards, PayPal, and many other options charge far less transaction costs. The problem here, as usual, is not with Bitcoin, but with people's misunderstanding of Bitcoin. And the first clue to that can be found in the skyrocketing price. If Bitcoin is so doomed, why are people still buying it? The answer is that Bitcoin's value proposition is not in making small consumer purchases, but in making large and important payments, particularly across borders. Payments in person for small amounts can be conducted in a wide variety of options: physical cash, barter, favors, credit cards, bank checks, and so on. Payments across the world, however, are a very different story. There are only a few currencies that are accepted for payment worldwide, namely the US dollar, the euro, gold, and the IMF's SDRs. The vast majority of international payments are denominated in one of these currencies, with only a tiny percentage shared by a few other major currencies. To send these currencies in values around thousands of dollars internationally costs dozens of dollars usually, and is subject to invasive forensic examination by financial institutions. Compared to these transactions, Bitcoin's transaction fees of $2.50 are still a bargain. However, the volume of these international flows is far larger than what Bitcoin's blockchain can handle, and if more such payments move to Bitcoin, fees will rise to limit the demand for them. Yet that would also not spell doom for Bitcoin, because sending these individual payments is not the limit of Bitcoin's capabilities. Bitcoin is money free of counterparty risk, and its network can offer final settlement of large volume payments within minutes. Bitcoin can thus best be compared to settlement payments between central banks and large financial institutions, and it compares favorably to them, being infinitely cheaper and more verifiable. The only other form of money in history which is free of counterparty risk is gold, and moving that around is incomparably more expensive. An interesting thought experiment is to imagine the shape of a global economic system built around settlement in Bitcoin. Bitcoin's current capacity is to verify around 350,000 transactions per day. The number of transactions can allow a global network of 850 banks to each have one daily transaction with every other bank on the network. The number of unique connections in a network equals n times n minus 1 divided by 2, where n is the number of nodes. Bitcoin can support an international network of 850 central banks capable of performing daily final settlement with one another. Such a network would have two major advantages over the current network of central banks. First, the finality of settlement on Bitcoin does not rely on any counterparty, and does not require any single bank to be the de facto arbiter, making it ideal for a network of global peers, rather than a global hegemonic centralized order. Second, the Bitcoin network is based on a form of money whose supply cannot be inflated by any single member bank, making it a more attractive store of value proposition than national currencies, whose creation was precisely so their supply can be increased to finance governments. In a world in which no government can create more Bitcoin, these Bitcoin central banks would compete freely with one another in offering physical and digital Bitcoin-backed monetary instruments. Without a lender of last resort, fractional reserve banking becomes an extremely dangerous arrangement, and the only banks that'll survive in the long run would be sound money banks offering financial instruments 100% backed by Bitcoin. They would settle payments between their own customers off of Bitcoin's blockchain, and then perform final daily settlement between each other over the blockchain. I'm currently writing a book, available on Amazon here, explaining Bitcoin's main value proposition as a sound money, and elucidating the significance of this concept across history, which far exceeds the significance of small transaction costs on consumer payments. Sound money has been a necessary building block of human civilizations, and its demise has usually coincided with civilizational decline. The modern world was built in the 19th century on sound money, funded by investors with the low time preference engendered from a sound money. The consumerist culture of instant gratification of the 20th century, on the other hand, was the culture of ever-devaluing fiat money, which discourages savings and incentivizes short-term orientation. The obsession with consumer payments in the Bitcoin community is an unfortunate relic of the fiat money era. Generations that have only known monetary hot potatoes that need to be spent before they devalue have come to view life as a quest of mass consumption. In a world of sound money, people will still consume, of course, because they need to survive, but consumption will come at a high opportunity cost in the future, since savings appreciate. As a result, consumption will stop being a compulsive part of life, and people will buy things they need and things that last for a long time. Instead of wasting their money on plastic bullshit they don't need and expensive sugary addictions, people will save their money for the future and, watching it appreciate, achieve financial independence. The number of transactions in a Bitcoin economy can still be as large as it is today, but the settlement of these transactions will not happen on Bitcoin's ledger, whose immutability and trustlessness is far too valuable for individual consumer payments. The reality is that buying a coffee does not require the level of security and trustlessness that Bitcoin offers. It can be more than adequately handled on second-layer solutions denominated in Bitcoin. Using Bitcoin for consumer purchases is akin to driving a Concorde jet down the street to pick up groceries, a ridiculously expensive waste of an astonishing tool. Consumer payments are a relatively trivial engineering problem, which the modern banking system has largely solved with various forms of credit and debit arrangements. Whatever the limitations of current payment solutions, they will stand to benefit immensely from the introduction of free market competition into the field of banking and payments, the most sclerotic industry in the modern world economy, owing to its control by governments that can print the money on which it runs. If the consumer payments view of Bitcoin were correct, the rise in transaction fees would hurt adoption of the network, leading to stalling in the price or a drop as the network is relegated to the status of a curiosity. On a day in which the price of a Bitcoin hit $2,000, this is becoming an increasingly untenable argument. From the settlement layer view, The growing adoption of Bitcoin is increasing its liquidity internationally, allowing it to compete with global reserve currencies for increasingly more valuable transactions, causing transaction fees to rise. As this process continues in the future, expect much higher transaction fees and a global Bitcoin settlement network to grow in importance. This episode is brought to you by the Fold Card. If you do not have a debit card that is paying you sats back for all of your bills, for paying off your credit cards with the PayPal bill pay, for paying for your groceries, for paying for your day-to-day, your Netflix subscription, if you don't get sats every single time you spend fiat, you are missing an incredible stacking opportunity. As someone who has been using the Fold Card for 2 to 3 years now, I'm not exactly sure, but I just pulled out about $7,000 worth of Bitcoin that I have stacked using this card and then purchasing gift cards through the Fold app. And I am able to use that stack to build a development project that I am super excited about and I'm going to be talking about hopefully in the coming weeks on this show. And I've had a lot of fun reading what you guys are going to do with your Fold stack and would still love to hear from anyone who hasn't contributed yet. If you have a vacation, you have a project, you want to put it, you're going to put it in your cold storage. I want to hear everybody who is putting their Fold stack into cold storage. Send me a message on Fountain or tag me on Twitter. I'm very curious what you're doing with your Fold stack and add hashtag Fold stack. I am using my Fold stack to build a project that I hope is going to be awesome for a lot of Bitcoiners. What are you doing with yours? And if you want to get started, 50,000 sats for free just for signing up. Check it out at bitcoinaudible.com/fold. And guess where you're going to find that link? In the description of this podcast episode. All right. That is a great piece. And I love that this was written back in 2017 before... I mean, obviously, Lightning was a thing in the sense that there was lots of discussion about Lightning and there was a lot of building on Lightning. But, you know, like even, I mean, I think it was within a month or two, it was very, very shortly after Bitcoin's existence, Hal Finney was talking about this very concept, how Bitcoin could increasingly become a settlement network or that it naturally would go toward a settlement network because of its scaling limitations and its properties as a extremely secure economic consensus network, as opposed to some consumerist payment network, and that it would naturally just move toward higher and higher value transactions, and thus could be a settlement network between banks, between financial institutions, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people immediately go to, oh my God, it's going to re-centralize, we're going to have blah, blah, blah. Well, even if you think about it from the context of like, oh, it would take us back to the free banking era. But I think that even that is a bad analogy. It's a good analogy in the sense of trying to understand the market dynamics, but I think it's a really bad analogy in the context of thinking about the barriers to entry to the market. You know, this is less about going to the free banking era and more about going to the era of being able to provide free banking as easily as you can provide a website to someone. The idea of Bitcoin as a settlement network does not mean it's amazing how much we can't break out of our framing of central banks and banking institutions and huge financial institutions as if these are fundamental and necessary parts of society rather than thinking about them as services that provide an explicit value, an explicit use case. They are literally providing a service. The question is, why do we think of those? Why do we think of the production or the provision of those services as something that only some giant financial institution or some central bank can provide? Because the barriers to entry have always been massive government restrictions and regulatory walls. None of those exist in Bitcoin. And I don't mean it in the sense that like, oh, the government isn't going to put up regulation around it. I mean it in the sense that we talked about with the episode, it's titled The Banks Are So Effed, and is by Cali BTC. It was read 703. But I think that is the correct framing. Going back to that episode, that is the correct framing to thinking about how the provision of payment services is going to be made available and how it will be provided on top of Bitcoin. And what scope, what availability of those services is even possible. This isn't a situation where like only these tools or only the ability to provide this service or do this for people to offer merchant services or to offer settlement or to offer payments or to offer non-custodial services and payments and settlement and all of these things, anything around finance and payments and monetary transactions and consumer transactions and private transactions and fast transactions and big transactions, all of these things, the whole hierarchy of financial instruments and services. None of those barriers exist in Bitcoin, and we're going to be able to do it all in a non-custodial and or trustless fashion. And specifically when we talk about trustless or trust minimized, we're going to be talking about specifically setting these systems up cross political jurisdictions, such that literally we are not. It's going to be about being politically safe, because that's the ultimate underlying value of Bitcoin, is its political neutrality on a global scale. It cannot be politically manipulated. It cannot be politically censored. It cannot be politically slowed down. It doesn't have regulatory walls. There are no political structures within the network itself. All of them are external, and they only exist in fiat on and off ramps. They only exist in translation between Bitcoin and some other monetary unit. So the analogy in the banks are so effed, the Cali BTC piece, or it was a thread, I think, is that he was offering a lightning tip service with like a shocking number of users on a set of Raspberry Pis, on two little $40 computers. And now his current project is actually Cashew. It's a federated, it's a Fedimint, or it's actually not Fedimint. It's not that protocol. It's specifically different. It is eCash. It is the Chaumian digital cash on top of Bitcoin. He's offering that as a service now. I don't even know what hardware he's running it on. But the important thing is that this is literally a payment service. This is a payment service. This is a privacy service. And to have it integrated with Lightning means that it is a settlement service between any other Lightning integrated exchange or a custodian or financial institution. And all of these things can be at the same scope and level as what Cali BTC is building. Another great example is the fact that I have a node with, I don't know, 20, 30 channels now or something. I have a pretty big position I have a decent node on the network with a lot of good connections, and I route and forward payments pretty much all the time. I don't even really do that much with it. It's just running all the time. So think about that in the context. I am literally funneling, I'm providing liquidity for payment services on a decentralized payment network. The thing is that sort of a system isn't even possible without Bitcoin. It cannot exist on a permissioned system. But on a system without permission, that cannot be censored, and that it is decentralized, politically neutral, and global, so that no jurisdiction actually matters from a technological perspective, you can build anything on top of that. We're not talking about Visa. We're talking about a collection of nodes running Lightning. When we are talking about payment services, we're not talking about BlackRock providing some sort of a payment service as if they're the only ones with access. We're already building hundreds of these services, and BlackRock hasn't even gotten permission to be involved yet. What we are talking about is an open global market for anyone with a computer to provide a service. And I think it's just a complete lack of imagination for people who can't get around this Bitcoin as a settlement network. Oh, we're just back to central banks again. It's like, no, you dumb. Do you even know? Do we understand why central banks even exist to begin with? Central banks will use Bitcoin, but they will increasingly only provide services to government, and increasingly more and more, all of the actual services that people use will be further and further disconnected from anything related to government. The whole point of distributing the trust problem and distributing the political jurisdictional risk will be so that politics doesn't matter. No local struggle, no local conflict, no local authority interrupts the operation of the payment network, of the settlement network, of the monetary unit. Nothing. That the entire stack of how we interact and use in Bitcoin has a series of trust-minimized interactions, fail-safes, and quote-unquote insurance clauses, just like the Lightning Network contract does, in which, in a progressive or in a hierarchy of worst-case scenarios, you keep going further down the list, you keep going further down the layers of money until you get to the foundation, until you get to the ultimate settlement where Bitcoin decides who the ultimate owner is. And this is why I think increasingly Lightning is going to be a settlement network. That's, I think, I have talked about this many, many different times on the show. I think we will go through an entire phase of Lightning as being the consumer-facing tool, the major consumer-facing thing, just like we had a whole era of Bitcoin and merchant adoption and everybody's using Bitcoin directly. And now we're moving into, if people are using Bitcoin, they're using it on Lightning. I think we have a whole cycle and some change, maybe two cycles, where Lightning is basically the thing for payments. But I think, just like Safe detailed out in this article, all we are going to do is continue to go up that ladder of higher value payments. And then Lightning is going to be too secure and too valuable and reach its scaling limits of 100x the payment capacity, or 150x, 1000x, whatever it is, and will essentially have to move off to layer threes or alternative layer twos. There'll be Liquid, there'll be Fediment, there'll be eCash, there'll be Arc, like all of these things. And how will they talk to each other? Lightning. They will integrate with Lightning. Lightning will have built out a massive global, like highly, highly liquid and capital intensive, or capital available payments network, global payments network with zero friction, with just move in any country at all, at any point, without even breaking a sweat, without even knowing borders exist. Lightning will do instant settlement between all of these layer twos and layer threes. And that's without even talking about channel pools and, you know, potential updates to Lightning that could give it another order of magnitude, or just a simple multiple of increase in efficiency and availability, and also security in that regard, like L2, removing the need to store, you know, previous transactions in order to secure your ownership or your side of the channel. But any way you turn it, Bitcoin is, I love the analogy of the Concorde jet. The one I've always used on the show, or I've used a bunch of times, at least on the show, is the same thing. It's taking a Concorde jet to go get your groceries. I think about it less because I think about it in the context of security. Like, I wouldn't say a Concorde jet is like super secure. It's just like super luxurious. Whereas Bitcoin, to me, I think a slightly more precise analogy, equally ridiculous, is like driving a tank around, right? It's like driving a tank to go pick up groceries, as if you need that level of security, or there is that level of concern. And I also think that, it's like trying to compare, like the idea of needing it to get there quickly, or that that Bitcoin's value. Oh, there's actually a really great quote. I think I saved this one. I highlighted this one somewhere. Yes. Okay. The obsession, and this is such a great, I think this is a great piece, or a great element into making sense of the misunderstanding of money, because in our consumerist era, we do not think about it as a savings vehicle. We do not think about it as its societal structure, the piece of it that is actually the most critical part of the monetary system itself, the balancing of society, the allocation of capital. And we think of it more about its use in exchange and how it behaves in exchange. So, because our experience with it isn't about savings. In fact, savings has been depleted. Like, savings is just this thing that we don't do anymore. The mechanism of savings we have for middle class America is buy a house with exorbitant amounts of debt, and the house will go up in relation to the value of your debt. That's quote unquote savings. It's equity in what is actually a depreciating asset from a value standpoint. Like, houses rot, they break down. In 15, 20 years, you need new shingles, you need You need to clean out your pipes. It just needs tons and tons of work. It's a depreciating asset. It's like a car. It's just slightly better than a car, but it gets old, it gets crappy, it falls apart, it requires tons and tons of maintenance. Anybody who's a homeowner knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's not an appreciating asset. The only reason it's appreciating nominally is because of the money. It's because our money sucks ass. It doesn't do its fundamental job. The only thing it does as a digital token is facilitate payments. But it's not even the money that's doing that. It's a bunch of payment networks. It's a bunch of services built on top of it that are walled off with massive permissioned requirements and regulatory hurdles that make us think that it's only giant banks and financial institutions that can even be a part of this. But it's just like thinking in 1950s or 1970s or something that the only people who make movies are the ones who have millions or billions and billions of dollars. And then we enter the age of YouTube, and then thinking that because we can analogize YouTube to cable television, that it means it's only going to be relegated to, you know, the three big news stations that are on TV, or, you know, the three big studios in Hollywood. But obviously the technology fundamentally changed the environment. Anybody with a phone or a home camcorder and 15 seconds of something funny can get millions of views. The dynamic is wholly and completely different. It has nothing to do with the structure that led to those giant centralized institutions. In fact, it's eating away the foundation that even props those things up as viable business, as a viable industry at all, as viable business models. That's where I was looking for. Jesus, I can't talk. So when we analogize YouTube as that means, is like it's a broadcast channel, it's a cable news thing. It's also a failure to think about it in the context of the power hierarchy that's involved in the cable news or Hollywood, is to completely misunderstand the direction that the technology is going. And I think this is the thing that, you know, when like people read Saifedean's argument, or they read Hal Finney's original thing about like it's going to go back to the free banking system, is a failure to recognize the new environment, that this is just an analogy to explain the level, the value hierarchy of settlement versus payments versus services and all of the things that take place. And, you know, actually, I didn't even hit the actual quote here. So, quote, such a good quote. "The obsession with consumer payments in the Bitcoin community is an unfortunate relic of the fiat money era. Generations that have only known monetary hot potatoes that need to be spent before they devalue have come to view life as a quest of mass consumption." Such a great quote. The idea that the payment mechanism is the value of the money, that the money is attached to the value of how fast and how quickly we can send it to each other, is such a fundamental misunderstanding of the foundation of money that leads to the reason anyone would build a payment system on it in the first place. And this is so deeply misunderstood by the crypto people and the people who hard fork Bitcoin, thinking that they're going to get 14 transactions per second and 20 transactions per second. This is going to make even a dent, even a ghost of a dent in the payments problem. The analogy I used way, way back when, and I still really like when it comes to comparing the scope of the payments issue versus the size of Bitcoin and what Bitcoin is actually valued for. The people who think that it's about fast and cheap payments have so lost the plot on both the meaning of Bitcoin and why Bitcoin is valuable, but also the sheer scope of the payments problem. And understanding that this is not about having payments that that can match today's current payment environment and the needs of today's current payments. Payments have been increasing by compounding percentages every single year. If what we are building is trying to recreate Visa, then we've already missed the mark by multiple orders of magnitude. We already are 100x too small for what is needed, while at the exact same time, it's compounding away from us. So we're already talking about, like, if we wanted to do that on chain, we would literally need terabyte blocks. Literally. Like we would just need that amount of information, which means we would have one node. it would, the only right way that you can fulfill as many payments as Visa does is if you have giant Visa servers, which means that Visa, Amazon, and Google would run all of Bitcoin, and there would be no security. There wouldn't be no auditability. You can screw up the auditability of Bitcoin, not simply by just, you know, making it permissioned and closing off and not making the data available, but just by cramming it with so much data that nobody can check. It's like saying that, like, oh, you know, I get all of the emails, so it's easy for me to verify if somebody's lying because I can just check the emails. But then you get 1 million emails a day. There's nothing you can do about that. Like, you can't read that many emails, so you can't verify anything. And having it there is kind of irrelevant. And we're just talking about matching Visa, which is one of multiple global payments networks or credit card networks, and one of an entire series of alternative payment networks from between various sorts of institutions and various types of payments of all sorts and all kinds. And it's getting compoundingly larger every year. So if that's our target, even by the time we got there, we would be so missing the mark. It would have run away from us so much. We need to be projecting out. We need to be looking 10 years from now. And what's the 100x, the 1000x transaction capacity that we need to get? And if we aren't preparing for that, if every improvement, if every fundamental shift that we make is not we can make it cost the exact same amount of resources, or maybe like 5% or 10% more in resources, but we can get 100x in payment capacity. If that's not what we're talking about, then we're not talking about the issue at all. And so going back to the analogy that I talked about in the big blocks or FUD, what was the article? Misconceptions is like five misconceptions about the scaling debate. Is understanding the size of the payment problem in relation to Bitcoin, and then thinking that a hard fork, or that your crypto coin, your Nano or Bitcoin 15, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin Satoshi's ass, whatever it is, thinking that any of those do anything in the context of the payment problem on a global, decentralized, consensus-driven network is like thinking, is like making and comparing that to Bitcoin. I say is like Bitcoin is a glass of water worth of like volume, and then they are bragging that they have like a bucket, right? They have like 10 times as much transaction capacity. And we're both standing in front of the ocean. I'm standing in front of the ocean holding a cup of water, and they're standing in front of the ocean holding a bucket. And what they're doing is they're saying, see, I'm the one that's going to be able to hold the ocean. I'm closer. When I'm just laughing at the fact that he thinks his bucket makes any difference at all. And even dumber is that by making the bucket bigger, it's leaking. The very nature of trying to hold more water in the context of like Bitcoin sacrifices its fundamental value, that makes it so that even though it is just that tiny amount of volume, it's still immensely valuable. It's still it's a multi-trillion dollar network easily. Because it's about monetary assurances. It's about settlement and final settlement and the assurance of ownership on the Bitcoin network from the context of the monetary unit, from the context of the UTXO and the cryptography that secures it, from the context of the attack vectors for bringing the network down, slowing the network down, or reversing transactions. It is all about the consensus around the security, around the finality of, do you own this? When Bitcoin says you own this, are you the one in control? Or can a government say something different? Can the president say something different? Can a regulatory agency say something different? Can an Amazon server farm who's really mad at you say something different? If none of them can say anything different and Bitcoin is the final truth, it is the one that dictates who owns what. That is a value that not even is just like a little bit valuable. It's something that literally there is no alternative for. It doesn't exist. Not in the digital realm. The best you got is a gold bar, but good luck shoving that thing up your ass so you can get out of Nazi Germany. The fact that people don't understand the astronomical value of that utility, and that is fundamentally what Bitcoin provides, is so crazy. It's like, we've been here for a long time. You know, it's not as if like this is the first time anybody said this. This Saifedean wrote this article in 2017. Hal Finney talked about this months after Bitcoin exists, and we are still having this conversation. And still Ben McKenzie is going on and saying just Bitcoin's just a story and people will just believe it, but there's nothing there. It's just air. Freaking God. I tweeted about that. I was just like, thank God. Just thank God that money works. Despite the fact that we don't know the first thing about it. If money, it's so funny. If we had to actually understand what the hell we were doing for society to exist, the thing would fall apart in seconds. The whole thing would just collapse and everyone would die because no one knows the fucking first thing about what is going on or why it actually works. And this is exactly why you put government in charge and you start centralizing it and you start putting experts in charge of it. It literally does die. It literally devolves into chaos and millions of people starve to death because we are that ignorant. We literally think that money is an arbitrary thing that just poofs out of existence. There's no fundamental utility. There's no fundamental elements, that it's just a story. It's just a religion that everybody believes in. And there's no connection to reality whatsoever. If you believe that, I mean, that's the most fiat shit I have ever heard in my life. And I think there is an element of only governments can produce money, and therefore money is a tool of authority. I think there is this element of like fundamentally fiat in that mindset that they just can't get out of. They just don't understand what value, they don't think about value, that everything is so potently attached to a hierarchy of authority. Who tells me I can have this? Who says this is the way it is? They're used to living in a fake world. They're used to living in something where everything is just a story. Everything is just fake. It is all just permission. Like, you don't have any rights. You just have whether or not the government says yes or no. And if they say no, they're going to kill you. They're going to put you in a cage. They're going to put you in solitary confinement. They're going to literally watch you rot and laugh if you just like oppose them or you say the wrong opinion. If you do not have a framing of the world without that, if that's at the center, and then you think outward from that mental model, then of course Bitcoin looks completely arbitrary. It looks completely nonsensical. Because who says it's worth anything? But yeah, this was a really great piece. I can't believe I didn't have this in audio. Another thank you to Anil for putting together that series, and I've still got like two or three, actually. I was surprised by how many I did not have in audio. I mean, I had like 80% of them or 90% of them, but I was missing a few. And so we are going to make sure that we have all of the fundamentals and that we have those critical pieces that just keep coming back. And a huge thank you to the Nakamoto Institute, always. It's been a very long time since I've gone back and read something from the Nakamoto Institute. And they are just a phenomenal resource. And I can't believe it's been that long since I've shilled them out and told people to go check it out. There's probably a lot of new people listening to this show who don't even know or haven't listened or read anything over there. So definitely go over there if you want to dig through the real fundamentals, the stuff that brought us here. That is an amazing resource. So I will have the link in the show notes. A shout out to Saif. I still haven't gotten into Principles of Economics, but I'm super excited about it. I have a link to his page so that you can check out his new book. And we will close that one out here. Also a link to Anil's list if you want to go through, find any of the other articles that I've done in audio, or you just want to read through and, you know, get ahead of us. But we will have them all available on this show without a doubt. So stay tuned. Stay subscribed. Do not forget to check out AI Unchained and keep an ear out because we've got some really, really exciting things on the horizon. And I'm really, really stoked to share it with you guys. So with that, last thank you to our amazing sponsors, Fold and the Cold Card. Fold is the debit card that is going to get you sats back so you can stack like crazy. And Cold Card is where you're going to put that stack. You're going to keep that shit safe and you're going to make sure you own it because you want your savings in the tank. You don't have to go to the grocery store in your tank, but you want the savings in the tank, especially while nobody else realizes how valuable the tank is and it's still easy to get a hold of. Buy your tank. Get a Cold Card. 9% off. All right. With that, we'll close this one out. Thank you, guys. I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Oscar Wilde.